Anybody here like Chinese food? Yeah? Okay. I have a confession that when I was growing up, my dad was a country boy, grew up in Nashville, Arkansas, which is a small town, and he grew up kind of a meat and potatoes kind of guy, and so Chinese food was not part of my existence growing up. In fact, my entire time at home before my before I moved out going to college, I can remember having Chinese food one time, and I don't know that my parents eat it still to this day. That's just who they are. But when I went to college, I fell in love with Chinese food. There was this place down the street from my college called Jade China. It was a hole-in-the-wall restaurant. It had about 5 tables you could sit at, and they served the largest portions of food that you could possibly imagine for about $3.50. And so that's a college student's dream. I mean, think about one of those takeout containers just overflowing with food and egg rolls and all that kind of stuff. So as you can imagine, being hungry college students, we would often frequent Jade China and go down and get the food. And the food was awesome. We loved it. I loved the Kung Pao. Take out the peanuts. It was perfect for me. It was great. But you know, the fun part of it was eating with a group of people on the weekends when we didn't want to go to the cafeteria. We would eat, go grab the Chinese food. But the fun part wasn't eating. The fun part came after the meal. After we got done with whatever, the food and the rice and the appetizers and everything, the fun part came at the end when we all pulled out our fortune cookie. We loved the fortune cookies. And of course, college students are a little goofy in how they do anything. And so for us, it wasn't just a matter of breaking it open and eating the cookie and reading it. No, we had special traditions that we did, some of which I'll share, some of which I can't because they are not appropriate. But what we would do is we would take fortune cookies and you'd break it in half, take the fortune out, and then you'd stick half the cookie in each side of your mouth. I should have brought one. I could have demonstrated this, right? So, I mean, you can picture that. And then we'd read the fortunes, and we'd add goofy words and expressions at the end just to make it funny, and everybody'd laugh, and it'd be a lot of fun. Fortune cookies, I think, are a lot are something that we all can relate to. And for some of us, and especially maybe those that are outside the church, they think about the Bible the way many people think about the fortune cookies. We look at the Bible and we assume that there's a verse I like and that's all I need, and so that's going to be help me to be successful in life. And many times we treat the Bible like a fortune cookie. And today we're beginning a new series where over the summer, the next 11 weeks, we're going to talk through one of the books of the Bible that probably has the reputation of being the fortune cookie book, and that is the book of Proverbs. If there was ever a book in the Bible that people love to just snatch things out of and say, oh, this is for me, it is the book of Proverbs, because we treat it very much like a fortune cookie. And I forgot about this, but I did bring some example fortune cookies for us to look at today. These were some I thought were fun. If you can't read them, I'll read them to you. This one says here, don't eat any Chinese food today or you'll be very sick. Hey, you guys are much more on the ball than the first service. That wouldn't get a laugh at all. Next one says this, Confucius say, if you think you're going to sum up your whole life on this little bit of paper, you're crazy. Very true. Next one says, help, I'm being held prisoner in a Chinese bakery. I just think that one's clever right there. This one is my personal mantra for life. Marriage lets you annoy one special person for the rest of your life. So Carrie can attest to amen to that one, that's my goal. And then this one, a foolish man listens to his heart. A wise man listens to his cookies. Now, I know none of us here would at least admit to this, right? But I wonder, do we sometimes approach the Bible that way? Do we sometimes approach the Bible as if it's this fortune cookie that we're to crack open and glean some wisdom from, just a very brief bit, and then move on? I would hope we don't look at it that way. But there is something about it, about us as people, that we love the fortune cookies, right? I mean, if you get a fortune cookie, you don't just throw it away. You always read it, right? Why is that? Because I think there's something about us that we love mottos, we love slogans, and we love pithy statements, pithy things that we can read and say, oh, well, I can live by that. In fact, it's not just fortune cookies we see this taking place. There's many things where we find examples of we go, oh, I should live by this. Just for example, here's a few quotes that I thought, I pulled up, Googled famous quotes, and here you go. One by Albert Einstein, in the middle of difficulty lies opportunity. So what do we do? When life begins to get difficult for us, when life throws us a little curveball, we'll pull up Albert Einstein and we'll remind ourselves, that's right, in the middle of difficulty lies opportunity, as if these few words are going to be everything we need to get through what we're going through. Or this next one from Henry Ford, whether you think you can or think you can't, you're probably right. And so we tell ourselves, that's right, so I need to do it, because if I don't think I can, I won't. Or that great philosopher, Yogi Berra, it ain't over till it's over, right? Okay, go ahead and lift hands. How many of you have used that one before? That's exactly right. I certainly have too. We all have. We're looking for answers. Unfortunately, most of the time when we're looking for answers, we want it to be in 120 characters or less. In fact, what's interesting is if you look at a lot of the preaching books and the public communication things that are out there right now, it tells you things like that. You need a bottom line. You need a single statement that people can tweet about, that can tweet out while you're speaking. So make that sentence, that one thing you're talking about, very short and sweet, because that's what people will remember. But that's what we're looking for, right? A lot of times, these sayings to live by, words to live by, things that'll motivate and encourage us, to help us find success in life. Well, what we're doing today, as I said, is we're kicking off this new series we're calling Summer School. Now, I know none of us like the name school. You know, for most of us, we're like, I'm done with that. Let's move on. But when we begin to look at the Bible, we understand that there are certain books in there that are in there to teach us how to live. They're to give us guidance, to give us wisdom. And so, as I said, over the next several weeks, we're going to be looking at one of those books, and that is the book of Proverbs, to find lessons in life. How should we live? That's the question. But before we jump into today's lesson, I do want to give us a little background on the book of Proverbs, just so we all kind of have an understanding. Proverbs is a book in the Old Testament. It's right after Psalms, so it's kind of in the middle there. And it's classified as wisdom literature. Now, depending on what scholar you read, there's basically three or five books that are classified wisdom literature. I lean more towards the three side of things, that there are only three books in the Old Testament that are considered wisdom literature. So it's Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job. What makes them literature is that in them we find instructions for life, how to live successfully. Or as one commentary I read put it, the perplexities of human existence are contemplated in those books. And that's what we find in Proverbs. Those three books especially, but we're going to focus in on Proverbs. Believe it or not, though, Proverbs is not the only book written like this in its time. Sometimes we assume that, oh, this must be the book of wisdom, the only one that was out there, but it really wasn't. In fact, there had been collections of wise sayings gathered for thousands of years, and at least 1,000 years before the book of Proverbs came about. It was common, just as it is today, for the older generation, parents especially, to look back at the younger generation and want to give sage counsel and advice to help them grow in wisdom and maturity. And so what we do today with our kids and with those that are younger than us is no different than what was happening in the time when Proverbs was written and even before, to prepare young people for life. And this is how they would do it. Proverbs is divided into two major sections. Chapters 1 through 9, we get kind of an inside look at a father and a mother sharing insight, sharing wisdom with their son. So we kind of get to sit in on the lessons that these parents are teaching their child. But what we also find in the second half of the book is probably what we're more familiar with. It's those wise sayings that we all have that are usually one or two sentences long. One of my favorites is just simply, you know, better to sit on the corner of a roof than in a house with a contentious woman. Sage advice, right? Men don't amen. That'll get you in trouble. Let's move on. Many times when we think about Proverbs, we think about it being Solomon. Solomon wrote Proverbs, and that's partially true. He wrote some of it, but Proverbs was actually put together over hundreds of years, and it wasn't just Solomon that contributed to it. As we're going to read today, yeah, he started it out, but if you begin to dig a little deeper, you'll find that some of the authors are identified just as the wise. That's all we know. It's just the wise. We really don't even know who that is. Some were listed as advisors to King Hezekiah. There was a guy named Agar, and then there was a king named Lemuel, who was also writers towards the book of Proverbs. These wise sayings were put together not just for the son mentioned in the early chapter as well. It's easy for us to go, oh, that was just for him. There's really nothing there for us. But what we understand is that when these books were put together, especially the book of Proverbs, it wasn't written just for one individual. It was meant to then, after that one individual had it, to be passed down to the next generation and the next generation and the next generation, so that it a broader audience was reached with the wisdom that's contained within it. So as we read through Proverbs, as we study this over the next coming weeks, you'll find that Proverbs isn't just for one person, it's for everyone. And it's very practical. And so today, what I do want us to begin with is looking at the main overarching theme and the overarching purpose of the book of Proverbs. Now, see, over the next coming weeks, we're going to talk about a lot of the individual topics that Proverbs addresses, things like pride and humility and anger and work and laziness and money and greed and all those things. We're going to break those down as well. But I think if we don't lay the foundation this morning, we will miss ultimately what the writers of Proverbs are trying to teach us. And that's where we get to today's lesson, all about wisdom. So if you have your Bibles or on your phones, we're going to look at Proverbs chapter 1. Proverbs chapter 1, the verses will be on the screen as well. And we're going to read these first seven chapters together. In fact, just to show you that it is the purpose and theme, my Bible even says that right there at the top, purpose and theme of the book. So see, we're picking it up, and this is going to lay the foundation for everything else we read in the coming weeks. Proverbs chapter 1, let's begin reading right at verse 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. For gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for receiving instruction in prudent behavior, doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance, for understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. And then pay particular attention to verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. As I said, these first seven verses really encapsulate what the rest of the book is going to be about, and that is wisdom. And I realize as I say that word, nobody really gets all excited about wisdom, right? Nobody goes, yes, that pastor's preaching about wisdom today. We don't think that way, do we? We want to hear about the other more exciting topics about greed or anger or pride, because then we can point to people we know that struggle with that. But wisdom, that's just about knowing stuff, right? That's just about how smart we are, or how, you know, is that what we're talking about? Well, if it's going to be the foundation, I want us to take a step back and talk about what are we meaning when we say the word wisdom, because if we miss this, I think we miss everything else. What is wisdom? I think it's common for us to think that wisdom simply means knowledge. In fact, as you read verse 7, the word, it says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. In that place right there, it is actually a synonym for wisdom. But what we need to understand is that even though there is some overlap between wisdom and knowledge, wisdom goes much deeper than just knowing things or knowing about things. In fact, here's something you need to know. You can have knowledge without wisdom, but you cannot have wisdom without knowledge. That's how this works. You can have knowledge without wisdom, but you can't have wisdom without knowledge. And let me explain this to you. Let me give you an example here. You could be the smartest person when it comes to Trivial Pursuit. You could be the greatest Jeopardy champion to ever exist and still be a fool. And maybe you know somebody like that. You maybe went to college or high school with somebody like that. They were the individual that passed every test. They aced it. They could knew every trivia answer to every question everywhere. But they absolutely had no clue on how to live. When I was in college, we looked at them and they said they had no common sense at all. They didn't know how to live. They didn't know how the world worked. They could go pass a test like that. But when it came to knowing how to interact with people and how to actually exist and live in the world, they had no clue. We would say they had knowledge, but they did not have wisdom. You see, when the writer of Proverbs, when Solomon here uses the word wisdom, when he talks about wisdom, it's interesting to understand behind that Hebrew word that's used there, it's not just wisdom, but it's skill. It's to be skillful in a trade. It's a skillful worker, someone that has the technical skills and knows how to put into practice what they know. It's one thing to be able to read a recipe and acknowledge all the ingredients that go in. It's another thing to be able to actually produce a meal that people want to eat. One of those is knowledge. One of those is wisdom. The skill to be able to put the knowledge into practice. Not just knowing, but acting. But there's even more to wisdom. It's not just that there's more than knowing things. It's putting it into practice skillfully. But as we've read in verse 2, we find that wisdom also contains insight. Verse 2 says, "For gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight." What is insight? Insight is just simply the ability to see things that others may not. When I was growing up, I loved to read some books, and they were Encyclopedia Brown books. Now, does anybody remember those or know those? I had a few head nods in the first service. Even Ryan, who knew? We had a love for Encyclopedia Brown books. I loved those books. You know why I loved them? Because they were mysteries. Encyclopedia Brown, boy detective, and his dad was the police chief, and occasionally his dad would bring a case home, or a friend of his would come around, and they would tell him about a case. My bike got stolen, my dog is missing, something happened. And Encyclopedia Brown would then go through the process of solving the crime, solving the case. And often when you got to the end of the story, what you'd hoped is that you had read it so closely enough that you were able to pick up on the clues throughout the story and be able to solve it before you got to the end. I'll admit, I was a little hyper as a child. I know that's hard to believe. And I have a skill for skimming books and not really reading for understanding. And so I often would get to the end of the chapter or of the story and kind of go, who solved that? What? Fortunately for us, it didn't leave us in the dark. If I remember right, you could turn the book upside down and it would tell you the clues and how he solved the case. So I knew where to get the answer if I didn't get it on my own. That's insight, though. Or that's, in my case, the lack of insight. Insight is the detective that can walk into the crime scene and notice 20 or 30 things about that room where everybody else that walks in only notices two or three. To be wise includes insight, to see beyond what actually is. It's this idea of understanding there is a bigger picture at play. You understand the bigger picture. You see things others don't see. That is insight, and wisdom includes insight. But it doesn't end there. Wisdom is also prudence. I'm assuming you use that word in everyday life, right? Prudence. It's a new word for me. I'd heard it before, but never really understood it. Verse 4 says it gives prudence to those who are simple. Prudence is simply knowing how to get things done. It's the ability to be strategic, to turn dreams into reality. And this is very important because this begins to show us that as wisdom is not just knowledge, it's skill. Wisdom is also prudent in that it begins to take action. It's not just about knowing, it's actually doing and strategically doing things, moving beyond talking about it and actually doing something. Prudence, like many of these words, can have a positive side, but it can also have a negative side. If somebody's prudent in a negative way, it means they're scheming probably for somebody's demise. They're working out a plan. They're hatching a plan and putting it into motion to somebody's harm, to somebody's demise. But on the positive side, what it is, it's discretion. It's resourcefulness. It's getting things done. And there's this idea behind that word in the Hebrew of prudence that is a shrewdness. We often think of shrewdness as a negative, but it's really not. It can be positive as well. It's that decisive or the discernment, resourcefulness, making things happen. Now, up to this point, when we've talked about wisdom with these descriptors so far, I don't think there's many people outside the church that would disagree with what we've said. I think many people would say, okay, yeah, that's a good understanding of what wisdom is. But this next one that I'm going to tell you, I think, is what differentiates between what I would call true wisdom and worldly wisdom. And that is this, that wisdom is relationship. This is where some tension lies of what people think about wisdom. But as I said, as we read through those first seven verses, verse 7 sums up the entire book of Proverbs and really gives us a great insight into how to be wise. Look at that verse again. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge or wisdom, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. The fear of the Lord. What Solomon is doing there is bringing into play to say there is an element of wisdom that is bound to a relationship, and specifically our relationship with God. And it's not just here in Proverbs that we find this, and it's repeated multiple times in Proverbs. We see it also in the book of Job, chapter 28. Job is talking, and this is recorded in Job 28. It says, "Where does wisdom come from? God understands the way to it, and He alone knows where it dwells. The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding." We also find it in one of the Psalms as well. Psalm 111, verse 10, tells us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. All who follow His precepts have good understanding. Put yourself back several thousand years ago to the original culture who would be hearing this over and over and over again. This was a repeated phrase that the Israelite people would have heard. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And what that means is there is a relational element that comes into play if we're going to be truly wise. Unfortunately, what trips many of us up is that first word, fear. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, because we've so misconstrued what fear means. We assume that fear there is talking about being afraid, cowering in fear of someone because of something negative. But just like prudence was a word that had a positive and negative side, fear also can be used positively and negatively. Yet a cower in fear like this in front of somebody, sure, that is negative. But that's not how it's used here in the Old Testament, certainly not in Proverbs. What it simply means here, it's a recognition that the universe has a creator. The universe has a ruler, and you're not it. It's a recognition that there is someone outside of us that needs to have our reverence and need to have our respect. I think of it like this. If I received a call today from the White House and they said, "Brent, President Obama would like to meet with you," that's a huge honor. That's incredible. Regardless of your politics, it doesn't matter. To meet the president is a big deal. And they said, "We're going to fly you up and you're going to meet him in the Oval Office at 9 a.m. Let me tell you what would happen. I would stand outside the Oval Office and I'd probably be pacing. I'd be wringing my hands and I'd be like, "Oh, this is a big deal." Now, am I afraid when I walk in the office that the president is going to smack me around? I might deserve it, but no, he's probably not going to do that. Why am I so nervous? Why am I wringing my hands? Why do I have this anxiousness? Because it's a fear. Because I recognize the office, the importance of the individual I'm going to spend time with. That's healthy. That's positive. That's the fear we're talking about. It's not that I'm afraid that God's going to smack me just because He's mad at me or I've done something He doesn't like. It's a reverence. It's a respect. It's an awe of the God who made everything, who's controlling everything. To fear the Lord means that I have to take myself off the center of the universe that I've created and put God in His proper place in the center. It means knowing who and what to respect. It means not thinking too much of myself or too little of God. That's what we're talking about. As I said, it's not running and hiding. It's in a positive way. It looks at God and it says, "You know what? I so recognize what God has done for me through Jesus Christ, through His death and resurrection, that my big concern is that I would disappoint Him. And I don't want to do that." It's a fear that says, "You know what? Not only do I not want to disappoint Him, but I want to please Him in the way I live and everything I do. I love Him so much. I adore Him so completely that it motivates a fear, a healthy, positive fear." And that's what we're talking about. Ultimately, everything I've said about wisdom up to this point, I think, can be broken down into two very short, pithy sayings. Here's your Twitter statements if you want them, following the good pastor books, right? The first one is this: wisdom isn't about what you do, but it's about who you are. Catch that. Wisdom is not about what you do. It's about who you are. I think it's very important that when Solomon writes this and he begins to lay out instructions on wisdom, what it means. So often, we come to the Bible with questions that the Bible is not going to answer. I know, amazing, a pastor just said that, right? Understand what I'm saying. You have a crossroads in your life. You have a big decision you have to make. Let's say whether or not to move to a different city, two jobs that are being offered, which one should you take? How many times have you been in that position and you've gone, okay, God, you've got to show me what to do? I'm just going to tell you, it doesn't say in here, take this job or take that job. It doesn't exist. Because the Bible is not so much a GPS giving you turn-by-turn instructions. The Bible is a compass. And what I mean when I say wisdom isn't about what you do, it's about who you are. To be wise is to focus on the character of who you are so that when you are faced with a decision, you have a fear of the Lord, you understand with insight and prudence and the knowledge that you need that you are able to do the right thing because of who you are. When we get bogged down in doing, it's to the neglect of who we are. The Bible, the Proverbs are given to us because its concern is not what you do, but who you are. I hope you understand that. I hope you get, I'm not saying what you do is unimportant. I'm saying what you do is secondary to who you are. And the writer of Proverbs, whoever the person was that wrote whatever one we're reading, I can tell you, it's about who you are, the person you are becoming, more than the decisions you're making. And the second point is this, I think, that we've seen, is that wisdom isn't about what you know, it's about who you know. Again, this one deviates from what the world would tell us wisdom is about. The world would tell you, go get all the knowledge you can, that'll make you wise. And right here, the Bible is telling us, no, it's not about what you know. It's about who you know and living in right relationship with Him. I think wisdom can be a very tough subject for many of us. It's not very exciting, number one, but it can be tough. And it can be tough for a few reasons. Number one, I think it's because of this. It's a problem for many of us because we think we've got it and we don't. Isn't that one of the problems of many of the people around us today? They think they're very wise, and many times they're not. Even Proverbs chapter 14, verse 12 tells us this. It says, there's a way that appears to be right, but in the end it leads to death. What's interesting is when you read through these first seven verses, there's basically three individuals that are talked about in this passage. You've got the wise person. It's kind of implied there's a wise person, the person who fears the Lord, the person who listens to instruction, has insight, prudence, all that stuff. We've already talked about that. But there are two other people that are mentioned in these first seven verses. The first one is mentioned in verse 4 when it says, for giving prudence to those who are simple. The simple, who are we talking about there? You know, honestly, what we're meaning there is the writer's talking about those who are young, those who are naive. Those who have just not experienced anything and they need some help and guidance. It's the young children. It's those in college. It's those that we need to look back and say, here's the things I've experienced I can pass on to you. That's the simple. The good thing about the simple is that they are teachable. The simple is not referred to negatively all the time. They're simple, are willing to grow and learn. But the third person is where the real problem lies. And that's the one mentioned at the end of verse 7 where it says, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. And there's a huge problem here because the fool is simply someone who thinks they are wise and they are in their own eyes. They're the person that says, I need no instruction. They're self-righteous and they're stubborn. They are self-absorbed and they can't see the big picture. They say, don't tell me what to do. I'm my own boss. I'll take care of myself. And what's sad is that in our culture, we talk about fool and we kind of play around with that word. But in Proverbs, it's a very serious offense to be called a fool. In fact, this week we have, every week we have what's called Message Community, where Ryan and I'll meet, and we've invited Stephen Wabanyaki from a live church to come in, and we get together for an hour every Tuesday, and we talk about today. We say, okay, here's what we're preaching on, here's the passage, what do we want to say, how are we going to say it, and we share ideas among one another. And as we were talking about this week, Pastor Stephen looks at me and he says, he says, Brent, one of the things that's really interesting about American culture is how flippantly you guys use the word fool. Stephen's from Liberia. He says, it is a major offense in our culture to call someone a fool. There is a seriousness behind that word. There is a real insult, and it should be offensive to us. And yet, for some reason, some way, somehow, we've taken that word fool, and we kind of elevate it. We kind of laugh about it. We kind of applaud it. Oh, you silly fool. No, the writer of Proverbs is telling us, don't be a fool. It's a serious accusation, not something to be taken lightly. In fact, if you look back at Genesis chapter 3, when you read the story of Adam and Eve in the garden and they take the fruit off the tree, what was the root of the problem of their sin? It wasn't that they ate the fruit. That was the result. Remember the whole character thing, not telling you what to do, but who you are? Here we have in the garden two individuals who have now set themselves up and they say, you know what? I know better than God. I know better than anybody. Who is he to tell me not to eat this? You know what? I'm going to eat it anyway. And what do you see is two fools standing there in the garden, two people who thought they knew what was best. We need to be careful when it comes to wisdom, because sometimes we think we're very wise when we're not. Now, the second one is very much pointed to this crowd right here, because I think there's an equally dangerous proposition when it comes to wisdom, and it's this. We think we're not wise when we are. Now, what do I mean by that? I think one of the greatest distinctives we have as a church is the fact that we are multi-generational. We have Pearl Becker, who is 4 months old, and we have Eileen Thomas, who in 3 weeks will be 91 years old. When you go outside Ashworth Road, if you find a lot of newer churches, and please, I'm not condemning them. I'm telling you, this is a great thing for us. But when you go outside our church, if you find new church plants, what you will typically find is a lot of people who look the same. They are the same age. They have the same. They're in the same phase of life. They're everything. I think that is tragic in so many ways. And one of the greatest assets we have as a church is the fact that we have a multi-generational church. The problem comes in is when those who are a little further along the path than some of the others, when they're asked to be mentors and lead discipleship groups and help guide those younger and maybe more inexperienced, less wise, that crowd looks and says, oh no, not me. I'm not wise. I can't do that. No, you need to find somebody else. There is a real danger here. When you have wisdom and you don't pass it on. We think we don't have wisdom when we do, and it prevents us from passing it on to those behind us. Do you understand that what we're talking about when we come to wisdom, it doesn't say you have all the answers. It means you are one step in front of somebody else. That's it. One step. You've had one more experience than they've had. You've had one more faith crisis than they've had. You've made one more difficult decision than they have. And you're willing to go in and invest the time and help them. You see, the book of Proverbs was not written for just an individual. I've said that. It was written to be passed down from generation to generation. But what happens if we stop the flow of wisdom? What happens if we say, yep, that's it. We're not going to share anything else we've got. Do you see a problem? I see a huge problem. I especially see a huge problem in the church if we don't do that. So what do we do to make sure we get wisdom? I want you to understand when it comes to wisdom, there's a few things I think Solomon points out here. And number one is this. Doesn't come naturally. This may offend you. I'm sorry. We're foolish. Foolishness is our natural inclination. That's the easy way, right? Brent's the biggest fool there can be sometimes. And that's because it's easy. Wisdom is hard. Wisdom needs to be striven for. It needs to be attained. You need to go after it. It's not something that just naturally falls upon us. We're not born with it. No one comes out wise. But wisdom is acquired. As we think about acquiring wisdom, here's a word of caution, though. I think it's very common for people to think about wisdom and they think, well, I know how to get wise. I'll go out and live it up. I need to go out and live life and experience life. Can I tell you that wisdom is never found in sin? Ever. And what you'll find is if that's your mentality, if you go out and live it up and say, I need to live this life and then I'll be wise, you'll find that you're coming back to the exact same starting point every time, which is the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. We don't find wisdom in sin. But wisdom doesn't come naturally or by default. We have to pursue it. And what we have to understand is that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. There's one other aspect that's very critical to understand, and that we find in the New Testament. Paul does an amazing job of talking about wisdom and how we can find wisdom in today's culture. You know, Old Testament, it's easy for us to go, oh, that's thousands of years ago, they were primitive. Well, what does Paul say about wisdom? In 1 Corinthians 1:22 through 25, listen to what he writes to this church. Paul says, Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, listen to this, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. New Testament scholar N.T. Wright says that all the lines of wisdom from the rich treasure house of the Old Testament come forward and meet in the one of whom all Scripture speaks. What's he talking about? Wisdom begins with the fear of God and it begins in Jesus Christ. The world tries to tell us what real wisdom is, where we should look, but God has revealed it, and true wisdom can only be found in Jesus Christ. We need to understand that. So as I wrap this up, wisdom, something that many in our culture scoff at, something that many in our culture don't think is important. In fact, we elevate foolishness as if it's a badge of honor, ignorance to be celebrated. But Proverbs tells us differently. Proverbs says and calls us to pursue wisdom. If you continue to read through chapter 2, 3, 4 of Proverbs, you'll see that there's an image put up here where there's a woman of wisdom who's wooing the young man, but then there's also the woman of folly who's also saying, come after me, come after me. And we understand that there's a choice, and the choice is what will we pursue? Will we pursue wisdom? Will we search for it and go after it? If so, we need to begin at the right spot. Square one is the fear of God found in Jesus Christ. We can't look at this book as a book of fortunes, the Chinese fortune cookies. It's a guide to wisdom. It's a guide on how to live. Not every step to take, but how to become the person who knows what steps to take. Many times when we think about wisdom and foolishness, we think of an all or nothing proposition. It's not true. Sometimes we can be wise in some areas of our lives and fools in others. As you think about your life, is there an area of foolishness that you know that you need a little godly wisdom in, that you need to surrender that part of your life to God so that you'll find wisdom there? Take a chance, take a moment this week and evaluate that. You see, this book that we're going to study over the next several weeks isn't about helping you to become a more moral person. It's about helping you to develop the character, to help you become a person who fears the Lord and who lives wisely. And I just remind you of these things because wisdom isn't about what you do, it's about who you are. And wisdom isn't about what you know, but about who you know. To be wise isn't to have somebody telling you every step to take and the right thing to do in every situation. But wisdom builds within you the character and the relationship with God you need to guide you along the path. So I'll warn you that over the next several weeks, if you're here and you listen to these sermons, there's probably going to be, your toes are going to get stepped on, because that's what it does. In the South, we'll tell you it's meddling. That's okay. It's going to be unsolicited advice sometimes, that person in your life that tells you, oh, if I were you, I would. That's okay. There'll be weeks it feels just, you know, like you're thinking, leave me alone. But just remembering, we're not looking at this as a self-help guide. It's helped to be wise individuals with insight and prudence, living in ways that exalt Jesus Christ and help others find the wisdom that they need in their lives as well.